Before we begin, if you want to join our growing group of supporters and give $5, $10 or $20 a month to help make the show even better, you can sign up to the Harder Reports Patreon right now and get exclusive access to full, unedited interviews with guests. That's the Harder Reports Patreon at patreon.com/TheHarderReport. And now, today's episode. Hello and welcome to the Hardy Report. My name's Edward Hardy, and for today's interview, I'm joined by Jennifer Palmer, who's running for office in Florida's 23rd Congressional District. Jennifer Palmer, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You've decided to launch this campaign against Democratic incumbent Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who's been in that seat since 2005. If there's one politician in the Democratic Party who is in Congress and represents the establishment, most people would see Debbie Wasserman Schultz as being that individual. And you're a progressive candidate. You believe in these progressive ideas that we're hearing. What made you say, enough is enough, she's been there 15 years, I've got to stand up and try and remove her from office?
Well, it was a combination of factors. But what you also need to know is, although she's been our congresswoman for almost 16 years, she was our Florida legislator for, you know, more than 10 years prior to that. So she's essentially represented this district for like a generation. And so it's just been a really long time. And when you look at where she takes money from, you realize that she's not actually representing us. She's representing special interests and corporations. And it's been going on for years. The fiasco in 2016 with her made her more of a national name, but the corruption and the cronyism is far beyond that. So in 2018, when I saw that we were able to get some non-corporatists into Congress, it just seemed like the timing felt right, that people were receptive to this idea of getting the money out and understanding what was at stake. So really, it was more of a timing thing. This is something that would have always been within what I would consider my organic purview, because just based on my academic background and my work experience, it's not far-fetched. But timing-wise, I think it just had to do with thinking it was possible.
As I was mentioning, listeners might be familiar with Debbie Wasserman Schultz from her tenure in particular as the chair of the Democratic National Committee during the 2016 presidential election, in particular because of how she had to resign. When her emails were stolen and leaked, they showed that under her leadership, the DNC had been biased against Bernie Sanders and in favor of Hillary Clinton. Do you see part of the work that you're doing here as putting forward this progressive vision, that it is clear that even though Debbie Wasserman Schultz is supporting Democratic causes, she's fight for things like Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, the policies that you're proposing on that progressive wing of the Democratic Party?
Correct. I mean, she, you know, at this point, it's really interesting because we talk about, you know, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and then we have this contemplation as progressives as to whether or not we should go with a third party, because the Democrats aren't really meeting our needs. And what I've realized is we don't even really have two parties. And you'll appreciate this as somebody in the UK. We don't have a Labour Party in this country. It doesn't exist anymore. And that's a huge problem. The Democrats are just as corporate as the Republicans. The only difference is on certain things like LGBTQ, pro-choice, like there's certain issues where the Democrats put up the appearance of being more liberal. But in reality, they all answer to corporate donors. So there is no Labor Party. And that's a huge problem. And the biggest thing that I know about the people like Debbie that represent that corporate class is that it is completely irrelevant to him what most people want. So in this country right now, 72% of Americans want Medicare for All. And so somebody who is a representative would be doing that, because your job is to represent those people. It's called the House of Representatives, not the House of Leaders. And so it's very frustrating when we have a, I mean, to me, she's an insubordinate employee. And so these are not radical ideas. That's the thing I want people to really understand. What we're talking about in terms of progressive policy would be mainstream in most other places. Any other if I were standing in Sweden, I'd be right in the middle. There's nothing radical about what we're talking about. And they've created this narrative, a very false narrative, to keep people afraid of all of these types of progressive changes. And she is very much part of that machine. So it's not just not doing what we want, it's perpetuating the myth that we can't even have what we want.
Why do you think politicians like that? Does it come back to that argument you were making a few moments ago about the control that donors have on these politicians, that wealthy individuals who profit from the current medical system in America or from the current education system, et cetera, put pressure on these members of Congress to not fulfill their duty, which is public service, but instead to fulfill the wishes of the people who put them in positions of power?
I think it comes down to campaign finance issue so that you have representatives that aren't on the payrolls of those corporations. But I think it's also very important to say that we have several industries in this country that we currently have as for-profit industries that should never be for-profit. So healthcare, public education, and corrections are all industries in this country that have been co-opted by corporations and are for-profit. So not only is there a profit motive to not give healthcare, we actually have a profit motive in this country to incarcerate people per person, per night, per facility. And it's just outrageous. So in addition to getting rid of the bought and paid for politicians, we need to eliminate the profit motive from several of our key infrastructure industries.
How would you seek to remove that profit-making element from them? Because it's so ingrained in elements of society.
Yeah, the biggest part of it is education, because most people, even in this country, have no clue that this is how things work. They don't understand it. They just, you know, and they don't have time because they're just trying to get by and live. So the biggest part of what we do with our platform, both as a candidate and what we would be continuing to do as a representative, is educating people that these are the things that need to change and rallying the kind of support and encouraging other people in other districts to run that also seek this sort of result of getting the profit motive out of some of these industries. And it is not easy, and there are not that many of us, so it's sort of like chipping away at this wall. And eventually it's going to crumble. It will, because more and more people are starting to wake up and realize that we are accepting far less than we're entitled to, given what we pay into our system. And I think a big part of that is just making sure that people understand exactly where their tax dollars are going and how they're not getting representation. So really, it's more of at the initial stages when you only have a handful of progressives. Obviously, you're not getting in and making sweeping policy changes right off the bat. That's not going to happen. But what you do is you use that position to get more people in there so that you do end up with a majority. And that's really what it's all about, is just chipping away at the corporate oligarchy. That's all we're doing.
That issue of how taxpayers' dollars are allocated is something that has really become a key issue during this coronavirus pandemic, because members of Congress on both sides of the aisle were very quick to rush through a coronavirus relief package that was over $2 trillion that included mostly support for businesses, corporations, wealthy individuals, and only provided one direct financial support payment for citizens, which was a one-time $1,200 check that a lot of Americans at the start of June still hadn't received, even though the law had been signed several months earlier. Do you think that, given we've got that recent example, the way that taxpayers' dollars have been just thrown at corporations and wealthy individuals during this pandemic eliminates any potential resistance that Republicans and maybe even some Democrats might have to ideas that you floated, like universal basic income, as ways to get people out of the poverty that they are in and prevent people from being in a paycheck to paycheck situation where crises leave them panicking and struggling to put food on their table?
Yeah, I believe it's 3/4 of the American people live paycheck to paycheck. More than half of this country couldn't afford a $400 emergency. So we were already at a breaking point. You know, we are a country that was ripe to be completely ravaged by a pandemic. We have no single payer healthcare. We don't have paid sick leave. So even if somebody is sick, they can't miss work. So they're out there spreading the virus, and we don't manufacture anything anymore here. So we were in as bad of a position as you could be to get a pandemic. And so it's of no surprise to me that our response has been completely substandard. The only reason that anybody's probably doing anything is because it's profiting whichever companies it is that they're seeking to profit, whether it's Big Pharma or any of the companies that have a financial stake in COVID. But yeah, they have no interest in helping regular people. We gave it was more like a $3 trillion when all said and done, corporate slush fund to under the discretion of Steve Mnuchin, who arguably should be incarcerated right now. So, you know, we did this in 2008 as well. In 2008, we basically bailed out every big corporation and gave golden parachutes to all their executives, and everybody, you know, else underneath lost their homes. So this pandemic, if anything, I am thankful for that it is opening people's eyes and more people are seeing exactly how our system has left us so incredibly vulnerable. We will, when all is said and done, I have no doubt that our country will have suffered the worst out of, I bet you anything, we will even be more than if you combined all the other countries together in terms of their COVID deaths, we are going to exceed that. I would predict that we are going to have the absolute worst possible scenario based on our complete ill-preparedness.
One of the reasons, as we touched on earlier, that has really exacerbated this crisis in America is the fact that affordable, accessible healthcare isn't something that everyone in America is able to access. And that's why you support Medicare for All, and you've put forward a Medicare for All proposal and agree with other members of Congress that are there and other candidates that are running for office who support that proposal. How much of a difference would healthcare make? Because a lot of people, again, like with the whole UBI thing, say, well, it's a really expensive proposal, but surely it's more expensive to have a country that, as you mentioned, is ravaged by a pandemic because it doesn't have the ability to sustain the economic and health impact of a crisis like this.
Right. Well, you know, when we talk about the negative impacts, let's remember that that's not happening to the top 1%. The top 1% of our country, I think they netted like over $500 and something billion just since this pandemic started here. So, you know, the negative effects are only affecting most of us. Unfortunately, we're not the people in charge. So, yeah, I mean, if we had single payer healthcare, we wouldn't be having, I personally don't think we'd be having many of the problems we're having, not just health related. There's this trickle up economic effect that would come into play. Medicare for All would be the single greatest change and benefit to people's lives in this country since the New Deal and, like, you know, with FDR. Because what's going to happen is, all of a sudden, the people that are struggling to they're having to decide between food and medicine, or that they're scraping all their dollars together to afford the nebulizer treatment for their kid's asthma, now those people will have disposable income. Those people now can say, yeah, maybe I can get that new car this year. Maybe we can do some extra Christmas shopping this year. So those things find their way back into the economy. When you give working people money, that automatically is going back into the economy. These people are not buying stock options. And so what we tend to do in this country is we give the money to the top that never goes back into our system instead of giving it to the people at the bottom. And essentially what Medicare for All would be, in addition to being what's moral and just and what's in our best interest health-wise, economically, that would be the biggest stimulus we would see in this country in decades.
Because people wouldn't be kept out of work because of health reasons, or in the current crisis that we're looking at, for example, people wouldn't have been so afraid to go to the hospital to get tested or to get treatment because
of being made. Yeah, and they would be able to take the time off of work to actually get well before coming back to work. So there's a lot of variables of this that are in play, but really, economically speaking, this would be the single greatest change to most people's lives, is to not be stressing about their health care.
You mentioned the FDR's New Deal. There's a New Deal that's been proposed by individuals that are progressive like yourself, which is the Green New Deal that a lot of Democrats have highlighted is an incredibly important way of addressing the environmental crisis that we're seeing from climate change at the moment. Obviously, Florida is a coastal state. There are shores around Florida with a growing threat because of human activity that's been going on. We can see industrial waste, pollutants being dumped off the coast into rivers and making bays toxic. With the Green New Deal, what would you like to see happen here to prevent this and reverse this damage?
The thing I like most about the Green New Deal is that it isn't just an environmental concept. It's really very holistic approach. So one of the best things about that Green New Deal is the jobs guarantee, which would put people to work building up a green infrastructure. So in addition to helping our environment, we have our infrastructure in this country gets a grade of D+ from our Army Corps of Engineers. So we're like on the verge of a crumbling infrastructure, whether it's pipes, sewage, you know, anything you can think of. And the reason that this is so huge here is because we have such sea level rise and the encroachment of salt water into our freshwater system. We are on limestone. Florida is built on limestone. So as sea levels rise, not only does it affect the coast, it affects our inland because the water is coming up and it's infiltrating our freshwater. So that's our drinking water. And this is a massive problem that we have, not just from rising sea level, but like you said, from the industrial waste and pollution that we have immense amounts of in Florida, Big Sugar being one of our biggest industries. And what that does is they block, it's where they're located on, there's a big lake in the middle of Florida called Lake Okeechobee. If you look at the state, there's a big lake in the middle. And the bottom of that, from the bottom of that lake, from the south of that lake all the way down to the tip of Florida, used to be Everglades. And that Everglades was used as like a natural filter for the water coming out of Lake Okeechobee and flowing into the ocean. It sort of cleaned the water. And because of where we have our industrial polluters, Big Sugar sits right on the southern edge of Lake Okeechobee, and they block the natural filtration process, and they also dump all of their agricultural industrial waste into the ground, which is then affecting our groundwater. We're getting these blue-green toxic algae blooms that are coming. We get red tide that's exacerbated. And so it's hurting our tourism industry as well as our environment. And what the Green New Deal would do is bring in a whole bunch of jobs to help build up the infrastructure that would be able to protect our waterways and protect our aquifer and protect our, you know, everything from the elements that may or may not be able to be controlled at this point. I think certain things are too late. But what we could do is be protecting ourselves and our drinking water from these elements instead of keep selling off land to more and more developers and not even requiring them to put money into rebuilding the infrastructure. See, it's one thing if you sell somebody and they develop a whole condo, but then they reinvest a ton of money into the ecology in the area. We're not having that. We're basically just selling ourselves off for parts here. So the Green New Deal gives jobs and helps build up our green infrastructure. We have horrible mass transit here, horrible. You know, we need light rail. There are so many things we need as far as like green infrastructure. And the Green New Deal is the only thing I have seen that really puts together a plan to put people to work and build up our green infrastructure.
The issue of building up infrastructure as well, not just because it's crucial with crumbling infrastructure in America, as you mentioned, but also bringing in jobs. One of the arguments used against the Green New Deal is this view that existing energy industries like oil and coal, the employees within them will find themselves without work as those industries are essentially sort of wound down or that sort of production in favor of renewable energy solutions. But the jobs guarantee that exists in the Green New Deal and the opportunities that would come from fixing America's crumbling infrastructure in a renewable and energy efficient and safe manner would negate that. Is that what you see from that?
Absolutely. And I think it's also important to recognize that there will be certain people in the fossil fuel industry, I'm sure, that will lose their jobs. And there will be certain people that might not be able to be retrained in a way that, you know, brings it into the Green New Deal. And it is unfortunate that there will be some job loss. And that sucks for those people, there's no doubt. But we cannot keep an entire industry that's killing the planet just because some people might lose their jobs. It is an unfortunate side effect when you change to new industries. Sometimes that happens. And we'll do the best you can. We'll do the best we can to mitigate those damages and give jobs to people. But yes, there will be certain job loss. But it's for a greater good that is undeniable. For us to keep going in the direction of fossil fuels is insanity at this point. Just insanity. And so I think that the concept of job loss is something that our right wing always likes to bring out as a talking point to stifle the discussion about renewables. And so we just can't allow that to be the case. So I do believe that that was the thought process in the Green New Deal, was to compensate for that and sort of take that argument off the table. But even still, even if there were to be certain jobs lost, sometimes that has to happen. Like, we don't need to keep coal mines anymore. Just because, yes, it's sad that those people will lose that job, but we're not going to keep a whole dirty industry just because of that. It doesn't serve us.
When it comes to elections in Florida, there's an issue that voters would have thought they'd resolved in 2018, but Republicans have sought to cause further issues there, which is that back in 2018, Floridians voted for Amendment 4, which would have amended Florida's constitution to restore the voting rights of individuals in the state with felony convictions after they've completed the terms of their sentence. So they've gone to prison, they've done the time for the crime that they've committed, they've served that, and they're back into society. Supposedly, as the criminal justice system goes, they've been reformed. So people believe in Florida they should then have the right to vote restored. However, Republicans in the state sought to undermine that amendment and voting rights as a whole. They've been unsuccessful in their attempts due to the court, but what would you do to protect and expand voting rights to ensure that that principle of one person, one vote, individuals who should have that constitutional right to vote are able to do so?
Well, first, let me be very clear that personally, I have never seen the connection between voting rights and criminal behavior, or voting rights and incarceration. So there are two states in this country where incarcerated individuals can vote, and I actually support that. I don't see the connection between these two things at all. So let me put that out. And I also don't find it to be constitutional, but that's neither here nor there. Right now, what we have is that 64% of Floridians did vote to restore voting rights to returning citizens. Then our legislature, like you said, they drafted legislation to further restrict and limit what we had just given them from this amendment. And then what happened was then that was brought to court, and the lower court actually ruled in favor of us, of the people. And now our governor is appealing it. So right now, our governor is appealing a decision against most of the people in the state. That's what our governor is doing, which is absurd. And I don't know whether or not he'll ultimately be successful, but I am telling everybody, as of right now, your voting rights are restored. Go vote right now. Go vote. If you request your vote by mail, and vote, because if you get it done, you're grandfathered in. They're not going to come back to you in a year and say you voted illegally, because right now it's good. But it's a massive problem. And again, this is all because our Florida legislature is pretty convinced that most of the voters that would get their rights back would vote Democratic. If they thought that these votes would be Republican votes, we wouldn't even be having this discussion. They would have automatically still had their voting rights. So this is really just voter suppression. And a lot of it has to do with this gets even more complicated, because I think a lot of it has to do with Trump and Ron DeSantis, and the fact that our governor was essentially put in place as the head of Florida in order to guarantee that Trump wins Florida this year. And so he's doing everything he can per his arrangement with the president to make sure that we disenfranchise enough voters to guarantee that Trump wins. This is how nefarious this actually is. But we need another Voting Rights Act. We essentially need another, and certainly within the state of Florida, you know, unfortunately, we're always behind the curve. But yeah, I believe everybody should be voting. And this is absolutely a Jim Crow type of situation here.
You mentioned Ron DeSantis, obviously, as governor of Florida. When you look at what Ron DeSantis is attempting to do in Florida to essentially prevent individuals who Floridians believe should have the right to vote from voting. And again, when you look at situations like what happened in Georgia with then Secretary of State Brian Kemp,
yeah,
people from voter rolls, how concerned are you about the way that elections are being manipulated here, and not just efforts to prevent people because of their beliefs, but simply because of Republicans are attempting to prevent any democratic challenge to their power? How concerned are you by that?
Very concerned. I mean, we have a huge election integrity problem in this country, and it's varying degrees from location to location. And where I am, we have one of the worst reputations regarding our election integrity. But I will say that we have different things in place than were in place in 2018. First and foremost, we have a different supervisor of elections. Now, our last supervisor of elections was literally friends with my opponent. Like, the appearance of impropriety was outrageous. Then she also got caught destroying ballots that were subject of a federal investigation, and nothing happened to her. Nothing. She got she was suspended with pay, and then she ended up getting her whole deal and her pension. I mean, nothing. Nothing happened to her. She was found guilty of violating federal election law and nary a repercussion. So I do have a lot of concerns. I do feel more confident in our current supervisor of elections. We have instituted something called a citizens election audit through a couple of our local organizations. And it's basically a citizen watch app that people have where they're going to be able to monitor the polls and try to track as closely as they can. But I have huge concerns. We should. I am fully anticipating that they are going to shut down a ton of polling places, and they will shut down the ones in the areas that they feel have the voters that will threaten the status quo. So I have a very strong base of support in some of our most vulnerable communities, because that is where I do the most service. So that is where I know the people. Those are going to be the areas that are going to get their polling places shut down. And I just know that that's how this works. And so we are doing the best we can to encourage everybody to do vote by mail, which also has its own problems, I know. But at least it's not going to be an 8-hour long wait for people to vote. So, yeah, they're going to do everything they can. They're going to purge people from the rolls. Certain people are going to go to vote, and they're going to be told, oh, you're not registered to vote. There is going to be all sorts of shenanigans, and we're just doing the best we can to run around and play defense on it.
We've heard about the issues that you're running on and what you would do if you're elected to office, and also about why people should go out and make their voice heard in this election and ensure that their vote counts. But finally, what would be your closing pitch to listeners and voters in Florida's 23rd congressional district as to why you should not just be the Democratic nominee in the seat, but should be their next member of Congress?
Well, and I'm sure you know, we have a very gerrymandered district. So essentially, whoever wins this primary wins. Like, that's just the way it is. That's why it's so hard to unseat an incumbent. We have closed primaries. I would say this, that what I represent, what my campaign represents, because I was asked to do this. This is not a career move for me. I have no ambition of sitting in Congress. My goal is to get the corporate money out and restore the voice to the people that live in this district. And really, I would love nothing more than to be there for as short a time as possible while being able to maybe mentor someone else who, you know, wants to come along, preferably younger than me, and really take that on. But that's what these representatives should be doing. They should be there and then passing the torch. This is a term of service, not a career. And that is the general theme of my campaign. And we have been doing community service, and people should demand that of their representatives. So the key reasons that I think I am infinitely better suited is I am not on a corporate payroll. I have no ambition for myself as this a career. So I have no desire to go to Washington and make friends and worry about where I'm going next and who I need to connect with. So this isn't a popularity contest for me. And then the other aspect is really changing, shifting the whole paradigm of how we view ourselves and what we're entitled to as a collective. You know, we fight over scraps that the oligarchs throw at us, and it's just not acceptable anymore. And so I'm really setting up an entire shift of what we should be expecting from our own money, that is what our own representatives are using to represent us, and just have people understand that we are being wronged and really understand that there is a better situation for us if we are willing to elect the people that aren't on the payrolls. So really, it's a pretty massive undertaking. It's a pretty big shift in paradigm, but I think it's very well received. We definitely need phone banking volunteers. You can go to gen2020.com. You can donate money, which of course we need money, but we also need phone banking volunteers. We have one of our phone bankers lives in Spain, so we crossed the pond. And you can also find us on Instagram and Twitter at GenFL23. We are also on Facebook at Gen2020. And we look forward to everybody checking in, following us on social media. That really helps a lot.
Jennifer Perlman, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That was Jen Perlman, who's running for office in Florida's 23rd Congressional District. You can find out more about her on Twitter at JenFL23 or at Gen2020.com. That's all for today's episode. What did you think about that interview? Let me know on Twitter at Edward T. Hardy. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star rating and subscribe. Recommend this podcast by submitting a review online and sharing it with friends and family. Thank you to this month's supporters on Patreon: Carolyn, Colin, Ibalashnikov, Janet, Jesse, Merrily, and Nikki, who helped to make this show even better. Until next time, goodbye.